Does climate change cause dementia?
That there's a relationship between environmental change, some kind of biological disease vector, and the risk profile of neurodegeneration, that should probably frighten us as well. Because this is the type of relationship that, broadly speaking, when we think about climate change, we're not naming at all as a society. Even in the most progressive public policy circles that want to wrap their heads around a changing climate and enumerate the health costs thereof, for example, all of the mortality and morbidity estimates of climate change are based on models that were created two decades ago and mostly think about things like respiratory health and malaria and, to a certain extent, cardiovascular disease. But neurological health, dementia risk, right, neurodegenerative risk, none of that is included in any of these models. And I think that we need to be paying much better attention to some of these forces if indeed we have any chance of confronting them accordingly.
That's Clayton Page Aldern. We spend an hour with him talking about his groundbreaking new book about the impacts of climate change on our brains, from PTSD to brain-eating amoebas. That's on today's menu for Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station at writersvoice.net or on your favorite podcast app. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Climate change is messing with our brains. It's making us more prone to conspiracy theories, less able to process facts, and more prone to violence. Sound familiar? In fact, climate change is a threat multiplier that isn't just making our environment more dangerous, it's making us more dangerous to each other. That's the conclusion of neuroscientist-turned-journalist Clayton Page Aldern. In his book, The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains, he explains how climate-induced stressors are shaping our mental health, our decision-making, and even the resilience of our societies. But it isn't just about stress, or climate anxiety, as it's often called. The Weight of Nature explores increasing risks to brain health from the knock-on impacts of climate change, warming waters that encourage the growth of organisms that can cause Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and Alzheimer's, or actually eat your brain, killing their victim within a week. Excessive heat, like the more than 100 days of 100-plus degree heat that Phoenix, Arizona is experiencing, can cook the brain, causing permanent damage. It's a Pandora's box of horrors that is truly terrifying. But amidst the grim realities, Clayton Page Aldern emphasizes creating parables of resilience. He says we can adapt, but we must redefine what adaptation means in the face of this crisis. Clayton Page Aldern, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Now, you used to be a neuroscientist, and now you are a data reporter for the online environmental journal Grist. Talk about why you made the transition from one profession to the other.
I love that question, not least because I do think that it has a somewhat reasonable answer in terms of painting a path that is ever so slightly less circuitous than it might otherwise suggest. I see myself as working on effectively the same questions, but just in a different manner. The answer as to why I left the lab is I didn't see myself interacting with people enough. It wasn't that I was uninterested in the brain, uninterested in questions of science, mysteries of the universe, knowledge for knowledge's sake, and indeed, occasionally, the extent to which we can apply that knowledge. But I found myself looking at a screen in a windowless basement a lot of the time. I was working as a lab technician in a computational neuroscience lab, which means I was thinking a lot about brains, but in addition to not really working with too many people, I also wasn't really working with real brain matter, right? This was an effort in modeling brains with computers. And so it felt a little disconnected from the entirety of the human experience. And I thought that science journalism would perhaps be one manner in which I could ask similar questions without necessarily burrowing myself away in such a basement. So by way of a public policy degree, I found myself eventually in an environmental newsroom, indeed asking those scientific questions, but publishing pieces of data reporting as opposed to academic articles.
So you needed that human connection, and also this is more about communication, but there was a moment that pushed you definitively in that direction. You read a Pentagon report on the threat multiplier of climate change. Talk about that moment and how that moved you onto your path.
Yes, this is really the moment that introduced me to the material in which I became specifically interested and which I ended up writing at great length about in this new book of mine, The Weight of Nature. I had a report come across my desk, as so graciously provided by a friend of mine, who said, hey, you should take a look at this. It's arguing that there are means by which the environment can act as, indeed you used the phrase, a threat multiplier when it comes to increasing the likelihood or the severity of future conflict. And it seems that the Department of Defense isn't arguing that this is the result of increased temperatures or crop stress or indeed economic stress of other flavors. It seems that they're saying there's some underlying psychology here. There are some specific statements they're making about the manners in which environmental change appears to be related to conflict between people, irrespective of some of these other mediating variables. And he put it in front of me because he thought maybe the neuroscientist within me might be interested in some of the potential pathways that might be leading to these kinds of conclusions, these kinds of results. And indeed, it was shocking, right? It was shocking, not least for the reason that the Pentagon isn't exactly Greenpeace, right? And yet here in this report, you saw them taking climate change very, very seriously, not necessarily because of what a changing climate was going to do to the world, but because of what it was going to make us do to one another. And I kind of couldn't get this idea out of my head that if you correct for all of the underlying sociodemographic variables, if you correct for economic conditions, you kind of push all of those factors statistically to the side and ask, is there a contribution of environmental change on behavior? It seems like the answer is yes. And again, the neuroscientist in me had trouble ignoring that conclusion, that there was something about rapid environmental change, something about heat stress, for example, that indeed appears to have a neurocognitive impact, appears to have a neurobehavioral impact. And I think it was that initial quite surprising conclusion adopted by something like the Department of Defense and very soon indeed corroborated in great part by a series of reviews that were published by top universities around the world. It was this set of conclusions that pulled me out of the lab and I think into the world of public policy, into the world of science journalism in a manner that specifically focused on a changing climate.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you went down that path because, I mean, I think all of us intuitively understand that. I mean, we know that when it gets hot, we get bothered. You know, hot and bothered is the expression, for example. But you go so much more deeply into this and exactly how this happens. But I want to begin where you begin. You start the book, Clayton Page Aldern. You start The Weight of Nature in the San Joaquin Valley, with a young mother named Desiree, and she feels a disconnect between a so-called normal life and, you know, what we do, the quotidian tasks of living, and what's really happening around us, the changing climate, the changing earth. And this disconnect is totally familiar to me. It's basically how I live every day. The climate crisis never goes away. It's always there, at least in the background, if not the foreground. And Desiree also tells you that her young daughter has no future. That really struck me, because for a young mother to talk about her six-year-old daughter and say she has no future is just crushing. Talk about Desiree and what she told you.
Well, I think you're right that it is an experience that perhaps we've all had in some flavor, this compartmentalization that we're asked to perform between the rhythms of daily life and the existential crisis that is manifesting in this omnipresent manner outside of those daily tasks, or allegedly outside of those daily tasks. And I think what Desiree makes so clear, and what so many other sources have made clear to me, and indeed what I've experienced in my own life, is that that compartmentalization is becoming more and more difficult for good reason, right? And the good reason being that indeed we are not somehow separate from this environment. There is no safety from a changing climate, right? This is a force that doesn't respect borders. It doesn't respect generational divides. It hardly respects wealth, though unfortunately, wealth can be somewhat protective against some of the most immediate effects of a changing climate, which is why you see the brunt of this force being borne by vulnerable communities. That compartmentalization that we're asked to perform, it becomes more difficult as these forces creep into our lives. And very frequently, I think that we hear people speak about this inability to compartmentalize, this growing awareness of, and I would argue, fear of a certain impending doom. You hear folks talk about it in terms of climate anxiety, right? This is a phrase that has become somewhat ubiquitous these days, eco-anxiety, a notion that meditating on these forces can be somewhat destabilizing, again, for good reason. It can provoke feelings of anxiety. It can be demotivating. It can lead to some kind of ruminative isolation, right? And I think what talking with Desiree, talking with other folks who are grappling in a very serious way with this notion of climate anxiety has illustrated to me is that it's indeed important that we are paying attention to this future. It is indeed important that we are reckoning with these forces in their omnipresence and in their doom and gloom. But there is a tremendous danger in the demotivation that can occur. There's a tremendous danger in that isolation that can be provoked by climate anxiety. And while this book isn't necessarily a book about climate anxiety per se, which I would argue is a force that effectively relates our experience of thinking about climate change to a mental health outcome, instead, this book is one in which we explore direct relationships between environmental variables and mental health, behavioral health, neurological health, right, brain health writ large. I still think that it's useful to meditate on the notion of climate anxiety for a little bit, because so frequently in the press, something like climate anxiety is framed as somehow aberrant, right? Even the notion of anxiety, right, the use of that word suggests that this is an irrational response. And I just can't think of anything irrational about looking down the barrel of the future that we're being served and responding with anything but the response that Desiree has so eloquently shared with us. So I think that we need to take climate anxiety very seriously, and also unfortunately, it's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the manners in which the environment is influencing our interiority.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Clayton Page Aldern about his book, The Weight of Nature. It's about how a changing climate is changing our brains. And I want to explore exactly how that happens. But before we go further, I would like our listeners to know that you don't just talk about the Pandora's box of horrific effects on the brain that climate change has in a myriad of ways, but you also say that we can create parables of resilience instead of, on the one hand, collapse, or on the other hand, some kind of Pollyannish sustainability. Say just a little bit more about that before we get back to how these effects really happen.
Gladly. I mean, we're talking about scary stuff, and inevitably, it's useful to carve some type of path out of this forest, try to think about moving in the direction of a solution. And when I think about what solutions look like, those that are most attractive to me are those that are motivating, right? If something like climate anxiety is demotivating, if it forces us to turn inward in an unhelpful manner, and indeed, I'm sure we'll talk about dozens of other effects that similarly result in a kind of shutting down of some of our internal processes that would otherwise motivate us to navigate the world successfully and perhaps approach solutions to the climate crisis accordingly. It would seem to me that the best solutions in terms of addressing these neurological and behavioral effects of a changing climate are those that inculcate a sense of motivation, inculcate a sense of desire, right? I'm much less interested in hope per se. I think hope can breed a certain kind of complacency if you believe that the world is just going to magically get better, right? Maybe that's blind hope, as it were. But something about parables of resilience, something about reaching back through history, noticing moments in which communities, societies have encountered great change, encountered really calamitous experiences, and moved through those experiences without collapsing, while also thinking about these stories in a manner that doesn't reduce previous communities, previous societies who have weathered change to somehow idealized Garden of Eden style communities, right? I think there can be a almost fetishization or exoticization, right? A kind of idealizing of indigeneity that is really unhelpful here, because we're painting pictures frequently of relationships with nature per se that may never have existed as such, right? In this idealized world, right? That we imagine. And instead, I think these helpful narratives are those that describe in very real terms examples of resilience, right? Examples of moments in which communities move through hardship, because that's what we need to do right now, right? We need examples of moving through hardship if we're to do so ourselves.
Let's go to more of the meat of The Weight of Nature. And we talked about climate anxiety. Some people call it pre-traumatic stress disorder. You talk about a kind of epidemic of climate-driven PTSD that awaits us. What actually happens in the brain with that kind of climate-driven PTSD? And fold into that answer what the psychologist Yoko Nomura found after Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, happy to. So PTSD is a psychiatric diagnosis that's offered under the Bible of these kinds of diagnoses, which is called the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual, the DSM, DSM-5, I believe we're on. And the criteria that define PTSD, right, don't discriminate between whether or not the source of trauma was a war or a violent relationship, or indeed an environmentally driven trauma, such as living through a hurricane or a wildfire. What's interesting, however, about climate trauma per se, and this comes from the work of a California neuroscientist named Jyoti Mishra, is that if you contract something like post-traumatic stress disorder as a function of climate trauma, if you are then exposed to a series of cognitive batteries, right? If somebody like Dr. Mishra puts you in a lab and asks you to perform a series of cognitive tests, the manner in which your PTSD appears to specifically bear on your abilities to go about your daily life looks slightly different from other cases of PTSD that don't have anything to do with the climate, that don't have anything to do with the environment. And in particular, it seems to be the case in her estimate that climate trauma per se breeds a flavor of PTSD that specifically seems to kneecap our abilities to avoid distraction, right? We become much less able to focus on the material in which we're interested in focusing. There's certain measures of impulsivity, certain measures of distractibility that are really disproportionately boosted in climatic PTSD patients relative to other folks with the condition, but for whom that condition may have been provoked by something like a war. And so I think it's worth paying attention to that kind of finding because, interestingly, again and again and again, when we look at these fingerprints of the climate on our brains, very frequently we find ourselves returning to this notion of impulsivity. Very frequently we find ourselves returning to this idea that as environmental variables bear on brain networks, we're seeing an inability to think critically arise. We're seeing an inability to offer rational balances to otherwise emotional or impulsive decisions that we might make, which is not to say that we shouldn't be basing our decisions on emotion some of the time, right? We need to be informing our decisions with the state of our bodies and how we're feeling about the world. And yet it seems to be that there's something specific about environmental stress that bears directly on this critical thinking network. You mentioned the work of Yoko Nomura, and I think it's indeed quite relevant here because what she offers is that we're not just talking about the present generation. We're not just talking about those who experience climate trauma today. Unfortunately, these traumatic markers are likely heritable. They're likely readily passed to the next generation. And the way that she figured this out and constructed the study is she was attempting to run a study that sought to measure the relationship between various modes of stress and maternal child health outcomes. So she'd recruited hundreds of expecting mothers in the New York area and over the course of a 10-year period was seeking to relate various environmental stressors to birth outcomes, to, again, maternal health outcomes, and indeed, over the first 10 years of life of the children, neuropsychiatric outcomes in both, you know, their interior environments and things like school performance, for example. And then Hurricane Sandy rolled into town. This is in 2012, I believe. And all of a sudden, she had a cohort that was split in half, wherein, you know, a handful of the expecting mothers in her program were indeed carrying children when the storm hit, whereas the other half had either given birth before the storm or indeed conceived after it. And so there was this natural experiment that had arisen where she was able to ask this question, okay, well, we're interested in stress and health. Here's one of the greatest environmental stressors of them all that has just waltzed into town. What happens? And fast forward 10 years to 2022, and she publishes the follow-up of this cohort. And lo and behold, children who were in utero during Sandy were drastically more likely, as early as preschool, to present with symptomology indicative of major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, OCD, ADHD, conduct disorder. And we're not just talking, oh, the risk had increased by 1%. We're talking, you know, boys had like a 40x increased risk of ADHD. You know, young girls had a 30x increased risk of anxiety, again, by age six, right? And what's likely going on here, as she would tell the story, is that, listen, stress, especially in utero, can be somewhat of an inoculating force. It's important for developing brains, developing bodies, to have a sense of what the stress profile of the world looks like, because otherwise you're not going to be able to respond to it accordingly, right? The world is a stressful place. We should have systems for dealing with the types of biochemical cascades that result from encountering stress. And yet everybody has a breaking point, right? If you are exposed to such an extreme degree of stress that the cortisol cascades, right, these glucocorticoid molecules that are kind of wreaking havoc in your system, do so at such an extreme version of themselves, it's no longer inoculating, right? A switch is flipped and you see risk profiles of corresponding neuropsychiatric conditions rise in kind. And the really unfortunate bit of evidence here is that these epigenetic changes that are occurring are indeed likely heritable, right? We're not talking about changes at the level of the gene. We're talking about biochemical changes that act on our genome, right? That increase the propensity for a given gene, you know, to be turned on or off, as it were. And those epigenetic changes can be passed from generation to generation. So you have this increased neuropsychiatric risk profile for young children who are in utero during a hurricane. And they are likely to pass along that neuropsychiatric risk profile to their own children later in life.
You know, what you're really talking about here are the impacts, and this isn't the only one, the impacts on our capacity, in fact, to develop resilience and to meet the climate crisis in the manner in which it is required. Because you also talk about how climate change creates amnesia, and that impacts our focus, that we have a decrease in the ability to process reality, to distinguish between truth and illusion, which, you know, you talk about Carl Friston, his theory. He says that the impacts of environmental change on the brain actually can cause us to be more likely to hold false beliefs with a higher certainty. And that could certainly describe many people in our political environment today. So how does that work, that, you know, these are actually eroding our capacity to be resilient? How does that happen in the brain? You described one impact of PTSD, but how do these other impacts work?
Well, we're talking about a couple different causal pathways here, many of which have indeed been proposed and elucidated by this neuroscientist you mentioned, Carl Friston. And his great contribution to theoretical neuroscience was naming the brain as a model. You know, he basically says that the thing the brain does is model the natural statistics of the environment such that you, the owner organism, the agent with conscious access to this model, can navigate the world accordingly, that you're not surprised by these statistics that you encounter, right? If you were kind of continually surprised by the world around you, if you were surprised that the sky was blue and that you had two hands and that occasionally water falls out of clouds, right? You'd exist in this state of constant awe, and probably it would be quite terrifying. Instead, your brain says, well, no, this stuff is normal. It's fine. You do have two hands. You don't need to be surprised by that fact. It stores these regularities of our environment and says, this is what you ought to expect, such that when you encounter something truly surprising, you learn something. You update your model accordingly. Something is different about your environment, and then you integrate that information into your model. So then again, you can continue to navigate the world accordingly. Now, the problem here is that the climate is changing, right? So with respect to our understanding of our meteorological environment, our climatic environment, you basically have this system that's baked into the pie that says, as the environment changes, we ought to update our model in kind such that we can continue to navigate the world accordingly. What does that mean in practice? It means that we're kind of indeed injecting a little bit of fresh amnesia into the system every time a long-term change occurs, right? We have a series of biochemical processes that are kind of whispering to us that the new normal is the thing that we ought to continue to expect. And that's just what brains were made to do. They were made to model environments, so we're not surprised by what we encounter in them. So if you have this insidious creeping force that is slowly mutating the environment around us, it is your brain's job to integrate that information into your model of the world. And so you will emerge from a series of long-term changes looking around and saying, yeah, well, this is normal. Of course, this is normal. This is just what the world looks like. There's kind of a second layer of unfortunate truth here that also says, and this is where Friston would argue that one of the things the climate is good at is, you know, basically whispering to us that these so-called delusions, as he would put them, are the things to buy as opposed to ground truth. It's basically a proposition that would say, as the climate changes, as environmental forces work their way into our minds, and in concrete terms, we're talking about things like air pollution, extreme heat. In the case of marine mammals and other marine animals, we're talking about ocean acidification, so change in the pH of water. Right, as these chemical changes in our environment manifest, irrespective of our brain's ability to model these changes, very frequently the changes themselves are inducing changes in our ability to update the model at all. And what I mean by that is, in again the case of something like an insect that relies on chemosensation, if a change in an environmental molecule makes it more difficult for that insect to communicate, if it degrades the sensory experience or degrades the communicative experience, that insect is going to have a harder time navigating the world. It's going to have a harder time updating the model with a reflection of reality because you've degraded the sensory systems that allow brains to have access to the statistics of the environment. If you can no longer smell as well or see as well or hear as well, you're going to have a harder time painting a picture of the reality that you need to be modeling. So there's this kind of really unfortunate two-pronged insidious nature of climate change. It seems to be the case. And the telling of these chemical ecologists and theoretical neuroscientists that in addition to the changes being slowly integrated into our understanding of normality, right? Updating our expectations accordingly. The changes themselves can occasionally be degrading our abilities to update our models of the world at all. And I think that's a very frightening prospect.
Now let's talk about the real horror show in this book, Clayton Aldern, The Weight of Nature. I'm talking, of course, about things like brain-eating amoebas and cyanobacteria blooms causing Alzheimer's, an upcoming dementia pandemic. This is really the scariest part of the book because you're talking about things that actually can become airborne. Tell us about the 10-year-old boy that you write about who died after swimming in a lake. And you know, what happened to him and why climate change is part of that picture?
Yeah, this is the scary stuff. I think you're right. And I don't seek to leave people in the fetal position here, right? But I do seek to paint a picture of what you named earlier as a certain Pandora's box of horrors. There is a lot of scary stuff out there, but I think that we need to be paying attention to it if we have, you know, any chance to confront it accordingly. The boy in question was a young man named Philip who, you know, lived in South Central Florida, and swimming in a lake one day, came home with a little bit of a headache, and was dead within a week. And he was dead within a week because the brain-eating amoeba that he contracted in this freshwater system presents a series of really serious stressors to the brain, namely because it is literally eating it. It's called Naegleria fowleri, and it loves to eat neural tissue. Behaviorally, right, and in terms of symptomology, it looks a lot like a kind of bacterial meningitis. But because nobody is looking in the healthcare system for Naegleria fowleri when somebody presents with symptomology consistent with a kind of bacterial meningitis, it's very difficult to diagnose. And so we need to be training healthcare systems accordingly, right? Healthcare professionals accordingly to ask questions about environmental exposures to which people may have come into contact with when they present with really serious medical conditions such as his. Otherwise, we're going to continue to miss these really serious environmental health vectors. Philip's case is extremely rare, right? I don't want to suggest that we're going to see an epidemic of the types of conditions that result from coming into contact with this kind of disease vector. And also, it's going to become less rare over time because these are the types of organisms that thrive in warming waters. And lo and behold, that's one of the fingerprints of climate change, warming freshwater systems. You mentioned cyanobacteria, right? Blue-green algae. Again, these are organisms that have existed basically since the dawn of time. They love sunlight. They love warm water. And they love our agricultural system because as more and more extreme storms loose agricultural runoff into streams and rivers, that synthetic fertilizer fertilizes these organisms. And so at these kind of brackish waters or indeed other freshwater systems, you see a series of blooms, blue-green blooms that are increasing in size and frequency over time because of climate change. And indeed, unfortunately, these blooms, by the estimate of the neuroscientists who have been looking into this kind of thing over the past four decades or so, these blooms release a neurotoxin that is one of the most compelling causal predictors of neurodegenerative diseases like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, right? ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. That there's a relationship between environmental change, some kind of biological disease vector, and the risk profile of neurodegeneration, that should probably frighten us as well, because this is the type of relationship that, broadly speaking, when we think about climate change, we're not naming at all as a society. Even in the most progressive public policy circles that want to wrap their heads around a changing climate and enumerate the health costs thereof, for example, all of the mortality and morbidity estimates of climate change are based on models that were created two decades ago and mostly think about things like respiratory health and malaria and to a certain extent cardiovascular disease. But neurological health, dementia risk, right, neurodegenerative risk, none of that is included in any of these models. And I think that we need to be paying much better attention to some of these forces if indeed we have any chance of confronting them accordingly.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, these are becoming airborne, the cyanobacteria, so that even people who live near lakes like this have an elevated risk for ALS. Also heat. I mean, I think, what was it? Phoenix has experienced over 100 days of over 100 degree temperatures. This is the new normal for the Southwest and the Southeast of this country, and certainly will be creeping upwards. Talk about the impact of heat on the brain, on cognition.
Gladly. And this is a great question because in the Phoenix context, I think we're seeing probably play out this dynamic that we're going to continue to witness elsewhere around the country and around the world that poses a series of follow-up questions, such as to what extent can we adapt to 100-day spans of 100-degree-plus weather? Unfortunately, the human body is not infinitely adaptable. We can biologically adapt to some of this stuff, but inevitably, prolonged stress of our systems and indeed acute stress thereof is simply unavoidable at a biological level at some point. And you know, what does that look like in practice? You'd asked about the cognitive effects of heat. We'd mentioned impulsivity earlier, and this is another great example wherein you see heat effectively acting as an additional cognitive load on our systems. One of the things that the brain does is, as I mentioned, kind of balance rational thought with emotional thought, right? In your prefrontal cortex, the kind of newest evolutionary swath of brain matter, the newest of the new is a region called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And it effectively works to, when you make a decision, balance the type of thinking that you're doing in a rational manner against some of the inputs that other swaths of that prefrontal cortex are receiving from the limbic system. The limbic system is responsible for encoding emotional regulation, such as regions like the amygdala that you've maybe heard of. And those emotional regulators are sending signals from your body to places like the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And when you make a decision, that VMPFC is being balanced by that dorsolateral, the DLPFC, so that you can combine critical thinking. You can balance it out with emotion. Unfortunately, given the additional cognitive load of heat, what appears to be the case is that dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is overworked. And so you end up in a situation, kind of a, I would argue, somewhat ironic situation, where one of the first things to go in the heat is, you know, one of our newly earned hallmarks of humanity, you know, really serious critical thought. You basically end up seeing an outsized influence of these limbic structures on decision making. And psychologically speaking, that presents as impulsivity. Accordingly, students perform worse on exams on hot days. We also see chess players unable to play the game that they're so good at higher levels of ambient particulate matter. Now, the same is true of Canadian members of parliament. They've been shown to produce less complex speeches at higher ambient particulate matter levels. Heat is a predictor of racial discrimination complaints. It's a predictor of the propensity of baseball pitchers to strike batters of the opposite team intentionally with their pitches. And I guess I'm enumerating a series of studies here to illustrate the fact that impulsivity and environmental influence on impulsivity writ large permeates our behavioral experience, right? If you are a more impulsive person, if you are someone who's exhibiting less critical thinking as you navigate your life, that behavioral change has ripple effects throughout your experience of the day and throughout your experience of interacting with the rest of society. So these are cognitive changes, but they're also, you know, social changes, they're cultural changes. And I think we're really, frankly, only beginning to wrap our heads around the, you know, unfortunate series of aggregate changes that are going to materialize accordingly.
Yeah, a lot of people notice, you know, that there's so much more aggression, you know, and I think a lot of people put it down to our political climate, but don't understand that it may have its roots in our actual climate. I mean, you also point out that temperature impacts decisions by asylum judges, and that there are far more denials of asylum when the weather, when the temperature, when the heat index is higher. And I just want to point out, too, when you talk about the particulate matter emissions, I mean, that is becoming a huge problem with the wildfires, with the increase in wildfires, and the impact of those on the brain and on heightening the risk of Alzheimer's is truly terrifying.
Yes, yes. And one of the reasons that we're able to kind of speak about extreme heat and particulate matter in the same breath here vis-a-vis neurodegeneration is that it's likely the case that they act on the brain in similar matters at a kind of biophysical level, right? They induce low-level inflammation in the brain. Inflammation is a good thing. It's a part of an immune response, for example. If you have a stressed system, or if you have a foreign molecule, right, a heavy metal that's been introduced into your brain tissue, it's great to have an immune response that, you know, involves some inflammatory promoter molecules. The problem is that if this exposure is chronic and that inflammation never goes down, neuroinflammation in particular induces a series of additional neurochemical changes that are intimately related to the types of cascades that result in death, right? Neural cell death. And neurodegeneration in its own right, right? Necrosis of neural tissue, cell death, is exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about things like Alzheimer's disease, things like Parkinson's. And so I think that, you know, there's something of a unifying logic here that's useful to wrap our heads around. And it says something like continual exposure to environmental stress can induce chronic low-level neuroinflammation that unfortunately is causally related to the risk of neurodegeneration.
So I know that we don't want to just inject a Pollyannish kind of hope, but you do say, Clayton Aldern, at the end of The Weight of Nature, that we can adapt, although there are limits to adaptation, as you've already pointed out. What does adaptation mean in the context of such tremendous changes in our environment?
Well, I think there are some adaptive band-aids that are useful. Air conditioning, air filtration systems, those work in terms of restoring the kind of loss of function that we're describing. But of course, that's imperfect. Air conditioning in particular is one of those technologies that, given the current distribution of you know, the global energy mix, is likely to only exacerbate the climate crisis in the long term. So we need to think past these kind of technological stopgaps and instead think about what adapting both societally and individually to a slightly more traumatic future could look like in practice. And, you know, societally, again, I think my main message is that we just need to be working toward a picture of the world that reflects reality accordingly, right? None of our climate models are taking these effects into account, right? For better or for worse, climate policy runs on a kind of cost-benefit analysis that says, you know, the price of climate action, the investments that governments must undertake to further climate solutions, they have to be worth it. And worth it in this context is defined as this cost-benefit analysis that through its calculus shows that the benefits that are accrued by the technologies in question offset those costs. I think that we're unintentionally kneecapping a lot of climate policy by not including neurological health benefits of climate action into such a calculus. So awareness, societally speaking, looks like the integration of this conversation into our climate economic modeling, into our healthcare projections over the next 50 years, such that we can confront that reality accordingly and prove that the types of investments that are so sorely needed are indeed, quote unquote, worth it. At the individual level, I think awareness is also the name of the game, frankly. I think that there's a lot to be said for practices of mindfulness. Mindfulness is so frequently spoken about in these kind of new age terms. And from a neurobiological perspective, there's a lot of evidence out there that suggests cultivating practices of mindful awareness, whether through breath work or indeed meditation, but most fundamentally through mindful presence, right? Noticing the environment in which you found yourself and how you're reacting to it. Noticing that on those hotter days, in those hotter moments, you are feeling a little hotter under the collar, a little quicker to the trigger, right? If you can point your attention toward these effects, acknowledge and name them, and indeed accept that they're occurring, you have a much better chance of being able to recapture some of the agency that the environment, I would argue, is stripping from you otherwise, right? And indeed, the neuroscience would suggest that mindfulness practices are restoring exactly the types of functional brain networks that are degraded by these additional cognitive loads, right? We see this again and again in terms of distractibility, in terms of impulsivity, right? Everything that we've been speaking about in terms of the manners in which climate trauma and climate change per se bears on brain health, aside from disease vectors, as it were, which is another story and a question of public health. Mindfulness is a series of practices that allows our brains to move past that impulsive frame and recapture some of that grounded presence that is necessary for balancing distractibility and impulsivity and emotional input with a slightly more critical take. So again, for me, I think it's all about awareness, where we define awareness both societally and individually.
Mm. Well, it is a wonderful book, and it is beautifully written as well, which is not always the case with such books. The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Clayton Aldern, thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
And thanks so much for having me. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Clayton Aldern is a neuroscientist turned environmental journalist whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Guardian, The New Republic, Scientific American, and Grist, where he's a senior data reporter. His climate change data visualizations have appeared in a variety of forums, including on the U.S. Senate floor in a speech by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Read an excerpt from The Weight of Nature by going to writersvoice.net. And here's a final note. This episode of Writer's Voice was produced a day after the presidential debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, and just a week after talking with Clayton Aldern. The very same day as the debate, I read a news report that the powerful heat-trapping gas methane that humans spew into the atmosphere is rising, and it's helping to turbocharge climate change. In fact, scientists warn that if we don't stop spewing it in short order, we won't be able to keep climate change within safe limits. That's because methane, which is massively released from fracking, gas pipelines, and gas appliances in your home, among other sources, is more than 28 times as potent as carbon dioxide at trapping heat in the atmosphere. And while a President Kamala Harris would be far better on climate than drill baby drill Donald Trump, her full-throated support of fracking during the debate threatens to undermine her own climate agenda. And now we know it threatens our brains and mental health. Climate isn't a partisan issue. We're all in this together. So it's up to each one of us to tell our leaders, no matter who they are, to put our safety and our future first. There's just a little time left, just enough for another poem by Palestinian poet Mosab Abu Toha. When time permits, we're reading poems from his book, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, until a permanent ceasefire in Gaza is declared. This is A Voice from Beneath. I want to drown myself in the silence of absence, to fill my pockets with poems and throw myself in a lazy river. A distant voice calls upon me to build a room from straw and clay, to raise a black flag in the night, to play the piano to the crossing owl. A voice from beneath shakes my desk. The ink spills on my drowsy pants. It pummels my fingers and constricts my breath. It asks me to stop writing heavy poems, poems that have bombs and corpses, destroyed houses and shrapnel-covered streets, lest the words stumble and slip into the bloody potholes. That voice takes away my voice. It squeezes my poetry pages, tears them from my head. Blood showers my curly hair. My desk becomes crimson red. Screams fill the cracks in the walls and the potholes in the nameless roads. That was A Voice from Beneath by Mosab Abu Toha. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.